just because I'm saying it out loud and you know by heart. Wow. Okay, I'm just making sure. I'm just I'll read, I'll translate.
That's lovely. Sorry, this is really
sorry.
You can look on with somebody, whatever. So.
It's a great excuse.
So we're literally on the last two lines of the Gemara on page Bet Amud Bet. That's where you left. And so when you took your break, you were introduced to a teaching by Rabbi Yirmiya, and some people say Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, right, about 2-2. To be. To be or not to be.
But in the shot, you see that. Are you up to 2B? Which?
Right, so 2B4. 2B4. I feel like I'm texting. The ancients had text.
It is here, but the translation goes through pages.
So we good?
Mm-hmm.
All right, great. So the Gemara is now going to take a little break. Right, so you were talking about, right, trying to understand a city and a walled city, and right, when you can make, you know, when you're supposed to say, read the Megillah, which days you are, right, so that was where, so I'm not going to review that for you, that's where you're up to, and that was probably a bit too much. So, but in the general style of the Gemara, is that often when they have a set of rabbis, they digress with more of their teaching. And it's not going to necessarily have to do with the topic. It's just going to be that, oh, by the way, we're talking about Rabbi Yirmiya and Chiya Bar Abba, so now we're going to tell you a few more stories. So we have three stories that are going to follow, or three teachings of theirs. We're going to go through that. We'll see what you have to think about it. But I'd like in your mind, right, at the end of the reading of it and the explanation of it, to say, like, kind of try to process, like, what's going on, right? Because the Gemara, right, the rabbis of the Gemara can include it or not include it, right? The redactor can do whatever the redactor wanted to do to make it seamless conversation. So, like, why put, you know, so it, I always like that question, right? Why put it in here, right? If it has nothing to do with the general topic of the halacha that you're studying, right, about Megillah, Why do it? So that's going to be kind of the back of our minds as I read through the Gemara. Okay? Great. So here we are. Having cited one teaching from Rabbi Yirmiya or Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, the Gemara quotes another teaching from the same source. Va'ama Rabbi Yirmiya, v'itema Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. And Rabbi Yirmiya said, and others say it was Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, who said, Mansapah. Sofim Amarun. The form of the letters Mem, Nun, Tzadi, Pei, Kaf were instituted by the prophets, right? And in particular, they're talking about the end letters, right? Because these are the particular letters, right, that have pairs. These are the paired letters. Sometimes they appear in one form in the center of the word or the beginning of the word, and another form in the back at the end of the word, right? So they're trying to figure out, like, so what's going on here? Where did it come from? Right. The Gemara notes the two difficulties with this statement. Tisbara, it is reasonable to say that these forms were instituted by the prophets. How could that be? How could those letters be instituted by the prophets? Right. In the back of their mind, they're saying, wasn't the Torah written? Right. What are you talking about, they're saying? Right. The Hakativ Eila HaMitzvot. But it is written, but these are the commandments, and this happens to be the last pasuk from Leviticus. Right, so, I like quoting. So, it says in the last pasuk, Ela ha-mitzvot asher tziva Adonai et Moshe el b'nei Yisrael b'har Sinai. And these are the commandments that the Lord gave Moses for the Israelite people on Mount Sinai. And that's how Leviticus ends, right? So they're saying, right? But it is written, these are the commandments. She'ein navi rashai l'chadesh davar me'ata, right? Which teaches that a prophet is not permitted to introduce anything new from now on. So like after Sinai, right, after the revelation of Sinai, they're saying nothing more, right? No changes to the letters, nothing changes, no new halacha, right? Even the rabbis and Rashi will bring, you know, would bring this up if you read Rashi, that they're talking about, right, even rabbinic law, right, has to source itself in the Torah, right? The rabbis, if they're coming up with a ruling, they're saying it's based on some pasuk, some of their reading. They might be reading it, you know, kind of like this, but they're reading it in a particular way to introduce something new, something categorical. But it always has to come back to the Tanakh, right? Everybody with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. After the Sinaitic revelation, no change may be made to the Torah. Therefore, how could the prophets of later generations have introduced new forms of letter? Right? Makes sense. Right? The Od Ha'amar Rav Chisda, and furthermore, Rav Chisda has said, Mem, the Samach Shabaluchot, right, that the letters of Mem and Samach of the tablets, if you're in Schottenstein, we're turning the page. B'nei Sayo Omdim stood in the place only by a miracle. Right? Because we learn from the Mesorah, from the tradition, right? What's the Samach, right? The Samach and the Mem, right, are circles. Right, circles. How could, right, and there is a tradition that the Luchot were written, right? The tablets were written where you could see it from both sides, right? Both sides, right? That's the miracle, right? So if you have letters that, right, it's one thing if it's a mem, like in the middle of the word, that's attached to the sides, but you have two circular letters, how could it, right? The only way it could stand in the center of the Luchot is by a miracle. They were suspended, right? They were suspended.
I wasn't thinking of the two sides, so the reason that it's so miraculous is because not only is it this side, but it's that side, and that means there's no corner that can be.
That's no corner.
In England, can read it from right to left and left to right. So that's why. No, so well, maybe it wasn't a miracle. Maybe it wasn't like this. Or maybe it wasn't on spelling.
Right, but I'm going to say that Rashi, right, that Rashi says, or that's, you know, that's just the tradition, that you could see it the same way from both sides. Do you have something to add or to say? Okay. Just check it.
Is there a final Samach?
No, there's not a final Samach. But the question is that's the question that the Gemara is originally raising, right? That's the Mem, Sadi, Kaf, Tei, the ones that do have final letters, but they're wondering, right, Rav Chisda says, well, if that's true, if it's already in the Torah, yeah, and he's thinking about the example of the suspended Mem Sofit and Samach, right, the final Mem and the Samach that are suspended in the Luchot, right, it's just supporting the Gemara's contention that the middle letters, the beginning letters and the end letters are in the Torah. And the Gemara is having like a lapse of memory or challenging a tradition.
So the convention that they're both front and back the same comes out of the Assyrians, where all the sculpture reliefs that had writing on them, they had it on one side, and then they had it on the side that was shoved into the mud brick, so that the gods could read it on both sides.
Okay. We have support there too.
But it wasn't hollow.
No, it wasn't hollow. It was 5 feet wide.
Writing from right to left also in Assyrian?
Yeah. Okay. Cuneiform. Yeah.
All the Middle East, right to left.
Okay.
They got it from us.
Which proves that the final form of these letters, children, the final forms of these letters were already used in the days of Moses. How can you say that they were instituted by the prophets of later generations, right? Saying like, come on, give us a break. We know that they were in the Torah. We have proof. We have proof that the scrolls were written. We have right before the rabbis. doesn't matter how, where you ascribe like the time in which the Torah was written down through Moses or before the second temple for the five books of Moses and then somewhere after that for the rest of it. However you believe it, it's come down into the tradition, we know it's before the rabbis. Right? So how could they make that claim? So the Gemara replies to this question, Ein mahava havu. Yes, that is correct. Both forms of the letters, Mem, Nun, Sadi, Pe, and Kaf, did exist in the time of Moses. V'lo havu yade, hei be'emsa teva, dehei besof teva. However, they did not know which form belongs in the middle of a word and which at the end of a word. Okay, so that was perhaps the confusion. It's one possible answer, right? And the question of, here's the question, how could it be? So confusion, where exactly the letters are placed. Okay? So the Gemara further goes on. Atusofim v'takinu pituchim be'emsa teva. And the prophets came and established that the open forms are in the middle of a word, the satumin besof teva, and the closed form of the the closed form at the end of the word. Okay, and the Gemara notes that this doesn't answer the second question asked above, which has to do with the prophets are not supposed to establish anything after the Sinai experience. So, Eila HaMitzvot, in the final analysis, the verse states that these commandments, from which we derive She'ein Navi Atil Chadesh Davar Me'atay, that henceforth no prophet will ever introduce anything new. How can you say that the later prophets established the placing of each form? Right, it contradicts that, right? Nothing before, right? How could it be? Or nothing after. And the Gemara modifies this response, right, their response. Ele shachachum v'chazru v'sidum. Right, rather they had forgotten them, the prophet reinstituted them. So someplace there was like a lapse of memory, they forgot them. Right, the rabbis are funny like that, I want to say, right, because if they're right, they have a bottom line, right? They have a bottom line. What's the bottom line here?
Bottom line is that the letters are legitimate.
The letters are?
Legitimate.
Right, the letters are legitimate, but what's more so is that they don't want anything happening after the Torah is sealed. Right, after Sinai happened, they're uncomfortable, right, even though they might be creating things and they might be doing all sorts of things. But like their platform, I want to say, right, the rabbinic platform is the Navi could not do anything new.
That decision was made. Do we have a sense of when that dictum was formalized?
I'm going to say, when it's the right. I mean, here we are in the Talmud, so it's in the Talmud. It's saying like, nope, the prophets can't. You can't institute anything. No, I think even in the Torah in Devarim. So it depends on who you believe is written by the Devarim. That nothing new can be added. Right, it says, the shoftim, right, of your generation can't really add anything new. Right. So there's somebody, whoever wrote Devarim, God, or the redactor, the Deuteronomistic tradition, whoever wrote it, said already, bottom line, we don't want anything changing. The Gemara reiterates it. So the Talmud is saying, we don't do anything new. Even though it's not true. Right, so that's the thing in the background. It's not true, but this is the bottom line, right? This is our position.
So it's not just context, it's even the form of a letter. The same letter. We're not talking about adding a new idea, adding a narrative. We're talking about a line that is the same letter. So I don't consider that to be in the exact same category as adding,
But the letter one could say, you change a letter, you change the meaning. Right, that's why you have echad or acher. A little chimchik at the back of the thing could make it easier. That's why we say that echad.
You're not changing the number, you're not changing the sound, you're only changing the mark. You're not changing a letter, you're just you're just making the same letter in a different stroke.
I'm just going to say, for them, that's heavy. Right? Yeah, yes, please.
I don't know if this is a problem, but we talk about Torah. We talk about Torah Shabbat.
Mm-hmm.
Torah Shabbat. Mm-hmm. So this is Torah Shabbat.
Which has been written down.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know whether the rabbis, while they were having these discussions in their academies, were thinking, wow, this is Torah Shabbat that I'm participating in, or they just were professors. But we say that the Torah that Moses received on Sinai was both Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebichtav, no?
Yes, I mean, according to the
so
tradition.
Actually, even the discussion about what, you know, whether you could make a change was already in what was received on Sinai. So somehow in there is the implication that if we talk about what's in the five books of Moses, of the Chumash, it's not the end of the story. There's a lot more, and it's open-ended.
For sure, the rabbis are, you know, we are an interpretive tradition. We are not literalists. We are not fundamentalists, right? And that's going to come up in the next little piece as well, right? We don't, you know, we do midrash. We do midrash for halacha, we do midrash for agadah, we do midrash. We don't do, you know, if you are a parent, when your child didn't listen to you at, you know, 12 years and, you know, 6 months, you didn't take them into the courtyard, bring them to the elders, and they weren't stoned. Right? We don't do that with the literal Torah. People are machal Shabbos, whatever that means, right? They desecrate the Sabbath, they don't do the Sabbath. Nobody's going and taking them before the people and stoning them. We don't do that. Right, we're not doing that because the rabbis already are like doing these, right, these interpretations to say that we have to be, whatever, kinder, gentler, you know, we have to make a society. The Torah is only the beginning, the platform or the formation of the society. It's not the society, right?
Well, we're never admitting, though, that they're, in fact, changing anything.
So everything comes from Moses.
Right, but I'm just saying that while they're doing that, they're simultaneously saying they're not doing it.
Right, and I think
they don't change the written code, but they translate it to where
we did that last year. When you, so then they interpreted, you know, what age is the kid, and is it a male child? And by the time they got done, there was nobody eligible to be stoned.
Right. So, but
they didn't change. They didn't change the Torah.
No, but I'm just saying that's the interpretation, right? Do we have lawyers around the table? Yes, of course you are. Not today, a few, whatever. But I'm just saying, you know, you do the same thing with, you know, constitutional law, with precedent, with all sorts of things. You do the same exact things that the rabbis did. But as long as there's precedent, they bring up precedent, and then they spin it. But it's about, you know, it's about each generation. Like, each generation is required to do, like, what we're doing, like, learning it and trying to figure out what's the implication for the present generation, for the people around the table, right? That's how it's kept alive. That's how we invite Moshe into the back of the Bet Midrash of Rabbi Akiva and doesn't know what's going on, right? And goes a little, you know, depressed, says, what's going on? I don't understand anything. And the bottom line was, oh, Rabbi Akiva says, how do you know this, my teacher? He says, you know, it was given to Moses at Sinai and, you know, relieved, you know. So I'm just saying, it's like, that's what this is about, you know. Moshe self wouldn't know what the Judaism that we're doing, but that we say that it's the Mitzorah, that we are changing it and not changing it, not changing the physical Torah Shebichtav, but changing Torah Shebaal Peh. You know, who knows what Moshe heard when Moshe was encountering God? You know? He didn't really write it down. Right? He only wrote down what God told him to write. Eileh HaMitzvot. Right? These are the commandments, not the stories, the experience, the encounter, you know, the knowledge of everything. You know, that's up to our imagination. Yes, sir.
Language, like a lot of other theories and science, established by letters, vowels, that were established before the full written code of the language like the Torah was written later by Moses. He chose Hebrew characters or whatever, or God chose, because it was in existence already prior to him. So the alphabet was already there before Moses. The vowels were there before Moses, and there was a spoken language. So everything was established a few thousand years or 100 years before the time that it's written. Mm-hmm. So why there is an argument on the basic code of the language? The whole language was established thousands of years prior to this event.
I understand that, but for the, you know, I guess for the rabbi, you know, for the, at least the teaching, right? This is the teaching of, you know, figuring out, like, where did the paired letters come from? Theoretical, who said it was a scholarly thing? It was, you know, was professors or doing a, during scholarship.
Yeah, but it was there before.
Yes, because, you know, because they're going to say that God looked into the Torah before the God created the world and created the blueprints of the world based on God, God's self looking in the Torah. So, you know, where is, you know, where is the Torah and what is the, you know, the written language and the spoken language? But at some point it gets concretized, right? That's the Chamisha Chumshe Torah.
Why are they asking the question? I forget last week why this came up.
Oh, this is the digression, as we are digressing into it, right? This
what
is a digression.
What was the topic that led to the digression?
It is for the teaching. This is based purely on the teaching of Rabbi Yirmiya and Chiya Bar Abba, right? Because the last, the piece that you left before the gala,
yeah,
the last piece in the understanding of the Gemara was their teaching. They taught something about understanding the city, the idea of the city, right? Because it was all about where, how and when you read the Megillah.
Yes.
Right. So the last teaching of the Gemara was Rabbi...
The distances.
Right. What? The distances. Right. But it was a based on Rabbi Yirmiya and the Itema Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba. So, as I said when I started talking, is that now we're going to have three digressions based on just their teaching. They don't necessarily have one to do with the other, and for sure it doesn't have anything to do with the Gemara. No, it doesn't.
Talking about distances, and then they started to talk about letters.
Right, but it was the same rabbi.
It's the same rabbi. These are the digression, right? And that happens often in the Gemara. There you say, oh, remember, I mean, this is literally probably what happened. Oh, remember, oh, Rabbi Yirmiya and Rabbi Shia, oh, I remember this story, oh, Mansapach, oh, they had this whole conversation, and they're probably saying, wink, wink, oh my gosh, what are they talking about? Wasn't the language written thousands of years ago? Wasn't the Torah written? And didn't they have Mems and Mem Sofit and Samach and that was suspended in the Luchot? All of a sudden you're getting into kind of their head about what are they thinking about, you know? And literally, I mean, because they're kind of hanging it on that the prophets, the Nevi'im, have nothing new to add. Right, I think, you know, they're like questioning themselves. They're saying, if the prophets don't have the right to add anything, wink, wink, can we? How do we find ourselves in this conversation? What are we doing? What's our project? You know, was it all forgotten? Right, if it was spoken to Moses, who brought out that it was Torah Sheba'al Peh? You, right? So Torah Sheba'al Peh. Okay, it went into somebody's mind. Where did it go? Into the people. Moshe taught it. You know, it ended up being the stories around the campfire. And then all of a sudden, I mean, I'm sure you know this, right? That all of a sudden, you know, they're faced with the destruction of the temple and they're wondering, how do we preserve it? Right? And the torture of how do you write something down that's only supposed to be oral? Right? Because the orality itself is interpretive, right? Because you play a game of an old-fashioned game of telephone, right? And don't just talk about hi, how are you, but you know, Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, da 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 da. All of a sudden, who knows what's going on, right? How it's being spoken and interpreted and things like that, right? And then and then they start writing it down because they're afraid that they're going to forget it. It's my phone. It's buzzing.
I always assumed that the final ones were because the words were written, the letters were written so close together to know when you were at the end of a word, would be nice to have a milestone.
Great. Keep that in mind, because we're gonna talk a little bit more about that.
And I wonder from this is totally made up now, blue sky, but I think if we think about it in terms of spoken language, the inflection at the end of words is different than in the middle of the word. And so I wonder, in terms of how the language actually got developed, whether or not the choice of a different symbol to designate was in fact an attempt to reflect the oral inflection. You see?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that when we talk, we're going to talk about interpretive, like language, language of translation and Ang language. They're going to bring up the Ta'ame Mikra, and I got something from the Aleppo. I found something on the Aleppo Codex that talks about the Masoretes. So I have a little handout, a little take-home present for you guys. So we'll look at that as well. So yeah, you're on the right track, because I think that's what's going to go on, right? Because these two rabbis are interested in language and interested in interpretation. Language interpretation and how you do that, right? And how you do it, and I think what are the frameworks?
By the way, these two rabbis were suffering from too.
I don't know.
Maybe they used to do the counting of the blood.
They could have been, but I think the Masoretic tradition is earlier, right? Is earlier than the Gemara. Okay, we good? All right. So here we are. Teaching number two, another teaching that was taught by Rabbi Yirmiyah and Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. Va'amar Rabbi Yirmiyah ve'i'i tema Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, and Rabbi Yirmiyah also said, and some say it was Rabbi Chiya bar Abba who said, Targum shel Torah unkulut hager amaro mipi Rabbi Eliezer v'Rabbi Yoshua. The Targum of the Torah was composed by Unkulus the proselyte, who had learned it from Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. So, show and tell. Because I'm not sure the Chumashim are downstairs, but I picked up a mikros sedolot from the back of the room. We'll pass it around. Every traditional Chumash, right, that's not linear or that doesn't have other stuff in it, but in a traditional Chumash, the Unkelus translation is on the side of the text itself, right? And Unkelus himself, unclear if he was the one who wrote it, and they're going to bring that up, who exactly, how did it get to this form, but it's not a direct translation. Okay, that's an important thing, that he puts his own ideas into it. So in and of itself, translation, as we know, is an interpretive tradition. When you read the Chumash, if you have the facility of language and you read it in Hebrew and you read translations and various translations, like what's the difference between a stone Chumash translation and JPS or things like that, or the Jewish Study Bible and things like that. So we know that people take license with language, right? You were saying, interpretive, because language is nuanced, right? Language is nuanced, and an original language says one spoken one way, and a translated language is spoken another way. So, if you want to take a peek, you can send that around.
When was he living?
He is. Hold on a second. I wrote that down. Give me a second. Okay. So here he is. There are differing opinions as whether Unkelus the convert can be identified with Aquila, who translated the Bible into Greek. It is related that Unkelus came from the family of a Roman emperor and subsequently converted and became a student of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua. So Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua are Tanaim. Right, so the Tanaim are the, 200. Right, the 100 to 200. So he's living, if those are their teachers, he's learning from them. If they,
Time of the Romans.
Yeah. He's a Roman, convert, but he studied, they're ascribing him that he's a student of Rabbi Yehoshua and Rabbi Eliezer. So, same guys that are hanging around Rabbi Akiva, same guys who are hanging around Elisha ben Abuye, right? All of those people are kind of living at the same time. These are students and their teachers. So he's second century, right? Second century. Okay. So that's Unkulus, right? And the Targum shall Nevi'im Yonatan ben Uziel. Amaru mipi Chagai Zacharia Umalachi. So I thought, my own name appears in our Gemara. How fortuitous is that? The Targum of the prophets were composed by Yonatan, it says here, or Yonatan, the son of Uziel, who learned it from Chagai Zacharia and Malachi. And we also know that he can't really learn it from them because he's living in a different generation, right? So, you know, once again, you know, it's this seamless kind of conversation about you can talk to the later prophets, you can talk to the early prophets, you have these conversations. I can read you a little bit from Yonatan ben Uziel. Very little is known of him, right? He was the greatest student of Hillel the Elder. His greatest project, as is related here, was translation of the books of the prophets from Hebrew to Aramaic. It is not clear whether the translation that is presently extant is his original one or whether it was really based on that translation. And again, it's harder to find him, but here's a Mikrot Gedolot. I pulled one out. And in the middle of everything, hold on a second. It's right. It's not even, because Radak is here, he's not even named, but it's here. You have to know that it's Aramaic, but it's the Aramaic translation, and it's all through the prophets. So, it's a good way to practice biblical Aramaic. Okay. So he learns it from Chagai Zacharia Malachi. The Niz Da'aza Eretz Yisrael Arba Me'od Parsa Al Arba Me'od Parsa. And when Yonatan, son of Uziel, composed the Targum of the prophets, Eretz Yisrael shook over an area of 400 Parsa by 400 Parsa, which is like the whole entire Israel at that time. However they understood what the land of Israel was, but everything had shaken because of it. And then we have this great experience. Yasta bat kol va'amra. So we have a heavenly voice who responds and says, Mi hu zeh shiyila sitarai livnei adam? Who is it that reveals my secret to mortal beings? Amar Yonatan ben Uziel al ragla va'amar. Yonatan, son of Uziel, rose to his feet and said, Ani hu shegiliti sitarecha livnei adam. I am the one who revealed your secrets to mortal beings. Galui v'yadua lifanecha. It is revealed and known before you. Shelo lichvodi asiti. That I did it not for my own glory, v'lo lichvod beit abba, or for the glory of my father's house. Ela lichvodcha asiti. Rather, I did it for your glory. Shelo yarbu machaloket b'Yisrael, that dissension may not spread in Israel. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So what do you think is going on? So she comes and says, what'd you do? Right, she called him on it. She didn't like it. The voice of the bat kol, be it God's representative something, doesn't like that he translated. No challenge to Unkelus, right? So let's put that on the table, right? No challenge to Unkelus. He did something. Okay. Translation is necessary. How people are going to access it, right? Don't forget the lingua franca of the time was Aramaic. How could they go into the synagogue? And perhaps they would read it in Hebrew and then in Aramaic, right? Similarly, we have the English translation of the Torah as well, read in some synagogues simultaneous, or, you know, however they kind of create the environment of being able to read it in both Hebrew and English. You have it on your lap. You can read it in the English as it's being chanted in Hebrew. So there's nothing against that. What's going on? What do you think is going on?
He translated the Torah. He translated it in the English. So it's a different books he translated. He didn't translate the Torah.
Right. Unkelus did.
Unkelus the Torah and Yonatan the Nevi'im.
Right. But
so
there
two
was
different books.
Right. Two different
sets of books.
Right. But the Bat Kol, right, so one would think, right, the Bat Kol is challenging
the
Nevi'im and not the Torah, right? And you would say, oh, isn't the Torah holy? Or wouldn't the Bat Kol, like, you know, push back and say, what'd you do? Right? But not. So what do you think is going on? Anybody want to venture a guess or a thought?
The Bat Kol challenging the fact that it was translated and made accessible
to
the people. You know, that's not unusual in other religions. You know, it used to be a capital crime to translate the Bible into English.
Right, but they're not challenging the Bible. They're challenging the prophets.
The books of the Bible.
The books of the prophets, right.
In our religion, it's the opposite. We are supposed to communicate scripture to our children. Everybody's supposed to participate. So
the Bible wasn't Jewish? Whoa, be careful there.
Well, a modernist might say that the historian makes history and the translator makes the Torah and the prophets.
What do you mean by that?
In other words, if you don't know exactly what, if it takes a translator to determine what the original actually means to somebody, then how that person translates it is really determines how the Torah can be understood.
So great. So you're approaching it. Good, good. Okay.
I
like it. I like it. It's good. I think that you have support here.
Yonatan is bypassing the rabbis. They say that Unklos's translation is based on Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yehoshua.
Mm-hmm.
But Yonatan ben Uziel based his upon the translation from the prophets themselves.
So there's like a overstepping his boundaries, maybe. Nice.
Well, by leaving them up. But one thing, Yonatan ben Uziel did write a translation. There is a translation of the Torah, too. So why is that left out of this discussion? Do we know?
What do you mean, that Uziel...
Well, there is a translation of Yonatan ben Uziel in Aramaic to the Torah. He didn't only do the Torah.
Right, right. I guess because the tradition has it that at least he wasn't challenged, perhaps, at the... You know, I don't know what the order, I have to say, I don't know what the order of his translation was. Did he do the prophets first and then said, okay, I did the prophets, now I'm going to do the Torah because there was Unculus already, right? I think he's after Unculus. Yeah, please.
Maybe.
I was going to say that either they did not want a general airing of the Nevi'im and did not want that to be as available as the Torah, or there was something about his approach to it that got to them. I don't know Jay's information about, you know, exactly his bypassing the rabbis, but I mean those could be the only kind of reasons why they would have a problem with his doing the Nevi'im, and I don't know which makes more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's try to discover that and think about that a little bit. Do you want to say?
Similar, I saw, I mean, people came and asked him, why did you do that? So he had to justify the reasoning. So he said, I want to make peace among our people.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought the story of the Bat Kol, and then she said, Dayecha, so she gave him the okay.
Right, we didn't get up to there yet. You're reading ahead.
So basically, it's just to legitimate the whole process.
Okay, and I think that the Gemara is going to also explore the whole idea that, you know, the Torah, right, it was important for the people to have accessibility to the translation of the Torah, to make it their own, right, and it's pretty clear, I think, at least in their mind, that, you know, you translate the Torah, there's not a lot of there might be a lot of interpretation, but there's not that much interpretation, just on the side, right? And with the prophets, I think that there are things written in the prophets that were complicated.
Political,
complicated, messianic, right? Like, it's all in there, you know. Isaiah, you know, Isaiah is part of, not the Ketuvim, right, the writings, Isaiah. You have Yechezkel. I mean, you're talking about, like, the mystical texts of the Jewish people at the time. There's like things that the rabbis don't want the populace to have access to. I think that it's about, you know, you have to have access to the five books, you know, and the rest of it, maybe not so much.
Yeah, but part of the Nevi'im is the history of the people at that period of time. So it's not only biblical, it really was the first historical account of our people through the land of the time.
Some is visions.
No, but most of it was really, even the vision is connected to the political, physical existence of the people in certain locations.
Right. I mean, I think it's really harder to say that it was history, because history is not really written or really understood the way it is until the Enlightenment, when there are, I guess, scientific approaches, Wissenschaft and things like that, and Wellhausen and people who like looked at the Bible as, you know, as history. Can we look at the
Bible?
I'm talking about Tanakh. I think it gives us a sense of this, of the narrative and the fullness of the narrative. I would be a little bit more hesitant to say that it's like the history of the Jewish people. It's like the narrative of the Jewish people. You know what I'm? You understand my pushback? I have just a little pushback, not a lot, but just a little. Yes.
So one idea that just came to me is, did they not want the other to be able to read what the Jews were speaking to one another about in the Navi? They didn't want the Assyrians to understand. They didn't want the powers who could really have the power over all the Hebrews at that time.
So right. So we're talking about the time of the Romans.
The Romans. But even so, they didn't want them. Is it possible that they didn't want them to understand?
I mean, I'm not sure it's an external experience as opposed to an internal experience. I think that, you know, I don't think they cared that much. I'm not sure, but what the Romans were thinking about their writings or their ancient traditions, because they were, you know, they were in the middle of slaughtering them. So I think that it was more like, let's protect ourselves. Especially right after this is like Hadrianic decrees, they're really getting, you know, they're getting decimated, so I'm not sure that they want to share that.
And it's filled with stories of overthrowing
authority. Right. And they don't want that either, right?
And corruption of power are the two themes.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
I don't know, I mean, that's a question. The Roman or any other controlling power in Israel never asked the Bible to be translated to the language of the land at the time? Any projects of that kind?
I mean, Greek, but I don't think it came from the Romans.
I think there were some translations that were officially of the government at that time.
That was the Greek translation. That's the Septuagint.
So if there was something like that, so what's, why?
But I think it's, again, I think it might be before.
If it's to Aramaic.
Say that again, I'm sorry?
So if there was already an existing translation of all those books to the common language of at the time, why the Bat Kol has to come a nunu on the Aramaic?
It wasn't available to them.
Yeah, but if they...
I think it was because the Bat Kol, I mean, I think that the Bat Kol is, it's about this internal experience. How much do the Jewish people need to know? And maybe it is about stirring them up and, you know, getting them, you know, it's like the project of making Jews a little bit more passive, right, pacifist, right?
So
it's
to preserve the rabbinic authorities.
And,
group in power.
Amen. All right, can we go on?
Yeah.
We good? All right. The Od Bikesh Legalot Targum Shel... Ketuvim, right? And Yonatan, the son of Uziel, also wished to reveal the Targum of the writings. Yasta bat kova amralo. However, a heavenly voice emanated and said to him, Dayach, you have done enough. The Nevi'im, okay. Ketuvim, no. My Tama, why was Yonatan, son of Uziel, prevented from composing the Targum of writings? Mishum de'it be'ket Mashiach. Because in the writing, it contains a reference to the end of the days when the Messiah will come. And heaven forfend, the people should know when Mashiach and the end of days would come.
If it's the end of days, how Mashiach can start? I don't know. That's a conflict.
Does this have to do with Christianity?
No, this has to do with Judaism.
What? So why are they so...
It's one of the 13... To la'amin b'viyat ha-Mashiach is one of the 13
principles of faith. No, I think that it's that, again, if we have to put it into context the way we've been doing it. I think it's just too dangerous for them. I think it's just about preservation. It's too dangerous. It's, you know, the rabbis did not like talking about the end of days, the world to come, Messiah. Well, I mean, it was already, Jesus was there and crucified, and, you know, there is the early, I mean, if we're in the six, right, if we're in the end of the 500s, 600s, we have the early church, right? You have already, you know, you have the Holy Roman Empire, you're there, right? And you're on the precipice of Islam, right? 650 is Islam, so, you know, we're in the midst of...
And there were dozens of messiahs, all of whom were crucified or killed by the Romans. At that time, many.
Are you talking about 500
yes.
or 200?
500, the Gemara. The Gemara is already, right, already, I mean, the latest, right, the latest scholarly, you know, closing, 600, 625, give or take. But already, the Yerushalmi is 500. Yerushalmi is 500 closed, another 100, 150 years later for the Babylonian. What?
No, I'm just trying to get in the chronology.
Right, so you have the Mishnah is 200.
Right, I'm back in the 200.
That's okay. So you just needed to, we just needed to jump you into the Gemara, the right, another 400 years. You needed to jump into the 400 years. Right, right. A big, and a lot has happened. Right, a lot has happened. Right.
So the mask. So if what you're saying is really applicable. So whose point of view is being expressed by the Bakul? That it's too dangerous for people to have access to these kind of narratives. The rabbi's point of view? So is it, who's telling this midrash?
Well, it is a midrash, so yeah, good.
So Rabbi Yonatan
God
is defying the rabbi.
Well, the rabbis, this is a story that's brought down by Rabbi Yirmiyah and maybe Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, right? So it's their story, right? It's what they were teaching, right? And the Bat Kol is the voice of God.
Okay, so yes it is, but...
Who has the, who owns it?
Who did not want people to have access to the...
To the messianic readings of it as an accessible way of learning it, it's in the mouth of the rabbis.
The rabbis. So it's actually very similar to the...
But they pull the trump card of saying it's the voice of God.
Well, Christians, historically, don't like access to the Bible. In England, until King James authorized the version translated, it was actually a capital crime. People were executed for translating. Catholics don't teach the Bible in Catholic school. They teach Bible stories. It's too powerful or confusing for young people to read the Bible. So that must be a continuation of a certain attitude that is being expressed in this passage, because I think that the rabbis,
it's an interesting thing. If the rabbis are thinking about who has access, and I mean, again, it's power and control. I think it's the rabbis are thinking about what they want to disseminate into the popular culture. Don't forget, not everybody is learned. We're thinking that everybody knows how to read. Right, we're thinking about everybody knows, you know, has access to that. I think that the rabbis in particular are the literate people, right, and they have the right of interpretation because they claimed it for themselves, right? So I think that they're the interpretive tradition and they hold the tradition and they're saying it's okay to read the Bible, which they did, right? And I'm imagining that in synagogue they read the Aliyah. And then there was the Miturgaman, right, which you can go into. I think several Sephardi traditions have that also, where they read it in Hebrew and then read it in Aramaic or whatever the language is.
Or someone is speaking it after it's
read. Right, that's what I'm saying. Somebody is speaking it after it's read. So it's, you know, it's being read, and that's okay for the Torah. It gets a little bit dicey at the Nevi'im, but the Bat Kol says, okay, you did it. We don't like it. but that's okay. And then you have the ketuvim, which they're saying, no, it's off, it's too much, right? There is a boundary. And we know that rabbis want categories, right? We know that rabbis like neat little packages where, and when you get into the ketuvim, if you think about it, they're not so easy. What are you translating? You're translating Proverbs, you're translating Psalms, you're translating Ecclesiastes, Song of Songs, you know, that's what I said, Ecclesiastes, Anglit, Kohelet be'ivrit, Shir HaShirim, right, Song of Songs, Esther, Ech is there, Job is there, even though we don't read it in any, right, Job we never read. Right, we never read in any ritual kind of way. And then you have Divrei Hayamim and those things. So you have a group of things that, you know, are ritually included in all sorts of things, and that's where the rabbis want it, right, to be included in the holiday cycle, right? Right, because that's a lot of, right, all of those that I spoken, you have Proverbs that work its way through the Tfilot, and you have Psalms that are in the Tfilot and things like that, right, the Sidur, it's the compromising of that.
Have we reached the point to which there's daily Torah reading, or are we still where it's less frequent than that?
That it's a real three-year cycle, as opposed to, like, it takes 3 years to read.
No, I was under the impression that early on, the Torah was only read every couple of years, and then
right.
the weekly reading through a one-year cycle was actually quite a bit later, but I don't know exactly when. I don't remember
that either. I apologize, but I want to say at least my recollection is post-Babylonian exile and the establishment of the synagogue for those 70 years until they came back into Israel, they were already reading the Torah weekly.
In one year
or in 3 years, whatever the cycle was, right? Because that was, you know, it wasn't like a third, a third, a third the way we do it, that certain conservative synagogues do it, but it was like a third, a full-on, a third, full-on, a third, and then you had a siyum of the reading of the Torah. So it was one of those. It was one of those. All right, so not too much. And I think that it's true. I think that if you think about it, you know, we don't really, you know, maybe of late, Jews talk about, you know, days, the world to come and Messiah and things like that. I don't think it's on the, like if we think about the topics that are taught, I don't think it's on the top 10, right? I think that, you know, just over the years and over the tradition, is like, we don't really talk about it because we don't really have the answer, right? We don't have, you know, the rabbis want, like, at some point they want the bottom line. Well, the world to come, what does that mean? Right? And that's why in, you know, Sanhedrin, what are they talking about? The world to come, like, Olam Haba when you die? Or Olam Haba when Messiah comes and the world, what? And it depends on who you're reading. Maimonides has his ideas, and, you know, subsequent rabbis have their idea. What does it mean? So they're not, you know, that part of the esoteric understanding, the rabbis are deflecting that. The rabbis are saying, you know what? We're a people of deeds and doing and thinking and interpretation. There's nothing to interpret if we have no, like, clue. And that's why it's on Maimonides' list of, right, of beliefs, right? Right. The essence, right? The core. Right, the essence of belief. So, you know, it goes there, and if you're in a traditional davening experience, you say it at the end of tefillah. If you're not, you just know it exists, and you say, you make a nod to it, okay? In those 13 lists, I can check off, like, what do I believe and what do I don't believe. Nobody's telling you, you know, that in a dogmatic way what you need to believe or what you don't need to believe.
This is very important. We are saying it every moment.
Well, be careful of who you say we, Kimosabe.
I think we heard a comment that Maimonides was criticized that in his writings he ignored the idea of,
well, I mean, he does. He believes in, right? He does believe in resurrection.
He doesn't pay to discuss it because it happens at the end of days and it probably only lasts a second, so why bother?
But I think that the rabbis are already deflecting that, right? Either because of Christian motifs of resurrection and of Messiah, or their own, you know, uncomfortableness with it, whatever it is, this is, we can see at least a little glimpse of saying, we're not, you know, like the Bat Kol is saying, enough. You know, enough, you can do it. Right? There's a strength to that, right? I'm a lenient parent. Sure, you want to do the Nevi'im? Okay, that's okay. Okay, I'm going to push it because I'm that child who has to push. What about Ketuvim? And then the parent says, no, thank you. Can't do it. Right. Good.